Welcome back to a special segment here on The Dirt Show. And if you remember a few years ago, I had a gentleman on the show by the name of Philip Van Tassel. He was pitman for a USAC stock car out of St. Paul, Minnesota. And he turned me on to Mr. Ken Spooner, who is my guest today. And Ken, you have written a book called Long Ride on a Short Track. And you actually sent me a copy. And when I slid it out of the sleeve, I was blown away because as I set off the air, my brother's a little bit older than me. He's 11 years older than me. So he remembers the coupe racing days. When I grew up at Cass and Speedway, there was only two coupes left, a coupe named V6 and also Don McAllister's coupe, and that was about it. But they were still pretty darn competitive in the late 60s, early 70s, so I can't imagine when it was all coupes what the racing was like, Ken.
It was unbelievable, particularly as they evolved from the actual beginning of stock car racing in the late 40s through the 60s and 70s. And there are some of those cars that were built in the 70s that could still compete with anything built today. One would be Charlie Jozombek's offset coupe, which is in the book. The engine was set off to the one side, and he drove from the other side on the right-hand side of it. It was an amazing car, all hand-built, his own ideas. They were just something to see, look, feel, smell. Colorful things.
And as you mentioned off the air, each region, each county, their track had these heroes, these drivers that everybody cheered for. Up here it was Mert Williams and Dave Noble who were running the coupes. And it would have been cool back in the day to be able to put a race together of all the best coupe drivers in the country. That would have been amazing.
Yes. Over on the East Coast, we had a promoter at the Islip Speedway, which got very famous because Wide World of Sports started telecasting once-a-year events out of there, figure-eight racing and demolition derbies, the more spectacular stuff. But Larry Mendelson was a tremendous promoter. He envisioned this thing called the All-Star League, and he brought together drivers from all up and down the East Coast to compete with each other on off night. They traveled. It was really something to see these guys. It was strictly cream of the crop stuff and driving talent. It was amazing. Like I say, you think, you know, oh, my guy in my neighborhood is the best in the world. And there was a lot of best in the world, that's for sure.
As we were also talking, I'm preserving these memories in audio version. So when I interview Doug Wolfgang or Richard Petty or Dave Bjorge or Mert Williams here on the radio, we're preserving it in our archives for people to go back to and listen in the future. And you are putting these stories and pictures down on paper. What we really want to do is for the younger people coming into racing and starting to become race fans is to be able to go back and learn about how everything started. Now, when I first opened your book, what really caught my eye was the divisions in racing. You had three basic divisions where you were going to watch the races. Same with me around here at Cassin. But the bottom tier of racing was virtually junk out there. It was the real basic racing vehicle. There wasn't much to them, was there, Ken?
No, there wasn't. That I drove one, so I definitely know it. It's amazing we didn't get hurt more often racing that stuff because it was pretty shabby. But it was something to learn in and didn't cost a whole lot of money, which is why, at least in my area, they was racing six nights a week on Long Island at one time in the early 50s. Some of these guys actually made a living at it during the racing season. Even the high end of the modifieds, $2,500, and you were going first class back then, you know, which wouldn't buy you a set of tires today.
I also know on the way to races one night, we were talking about some of the innovations in racing. For example, the fuel cell. We remember the days where a fuel cell was a army jerry can welded in the back window of a street stock, and they were dumping fuel in the window while the driver was pushing the throttle, revving up the engine to keep it running while they took off from the pit stop.
That was all fuel cell. I know from my own experience, the early part of my book, the first chapters, is my brief career as a driver. It took me almost like 10 years to get out there because I was 10 when I first saw them, but I was 18 when I actually got to drive one. And I had my gas tank actually fall out of the car one night at the very start of the race. And fortunately, on a technicality, I was bounced out of the beginner class into the sportsman experienced class with the gas tank falling out and spilling gas all through the car on me. The tank was coming out, regardless of what race I was in. If I wasn't in that sportsman division, I probably would have got barbecued that night.
And you also look at the great safety equipment the drivers were wearing. Many of them didn't have goggles, had a leather helmet, were wearing T-shirts, fireproof clothing, and maybe a seatbelt.
Yeah, we wore belts. I'm talking mid-60s when I did it, but I read a newspaper article of a pretty bad pileup in the late 50s, and one driver was unconscious, and they found out he was wearing a toy concession helmet. They took some chances, to say the least. We wore the 3-inch Army surplus, so aircraft surplus belts and harnesses, but no fire suits were required. I raced in a T-shirt and jeans. That was it. Helmets, the Cromwell helmets, which were very popular, were practically worthless. They were Masonite. That's what they were made out of. And if they were ever banged even the slightest bit, they would fall apart like an egg. The Bell helmet was priced out of a lot of people's ability to have one, but it definitely saved a few heads. I know I borrowed one, and it saved me when I got T-boned, I think, from a whole lot worse injury. All I got was my bell rung.
My friend Glenn Anderson, he still has his Cromwell helmet from the 50s at the Minnesota State Fair, and somebody threw a rock up and hit him right in the helmet, and he coasted into the pits, got out of the car, and sat on his toolbox. Well, he thought it was his toolbox, and after the race, the driver pulled in, goes, "What the heck are you doing in my pit?" Another story I heard about safety belts was Dwayne Carter happened to be using a lap belt for the first time and somebody walked over. And I think one of the things that people didn't really input the safety equipment back then was a macho thing. If you were a race driver, you didn't want to show that you were a sissy by wearing a fire suit or a face shield or anything like that because nobody else was doing it. And somebody looked in his cockpit and said, "Oh, you got a lap belt on," started to chuckle. And he said, "That's not to keep me in the car, it's to keep my foot planted on the accelerator when I bounce over the ruts."
Wow. One of the drivers featured in the book is named Bruno Bracchi, and he was in World War II, and he was using a harness. He had to hide it when he ran NASCAR. They weren't allowing that, believe it or not. Bruno, as mentioned to you earlier, was a mentor to Mario Andretti, taught him a whole lot. And when I met Mario, just the mention of Bruno's name just lit Mario up like it was just yesterday.
The photography in your book is unbelievable, the collection of pictures. Are those your personal pictures, or how did you get a hold of those?
No, most of them, I would say 90% of them, came from one gentleman who's featured in the book named Marty Himes, who has a museum on Long Island. And it's the most phenomenal privately funded museum. It's in his home. There's a chapter devoted to basically what's in that museum. I coined the phrase, "Nobody has more stuff." And Marty started with one photograph. He was an ex-driver from the very earliest days. Started driving when he was like 15 or 16. And he started out with one photograph of a one-legged driver named Bill Schindler, who was killed back in the 50s driving big cars. And it has grown to be phenomenal. Included at that cover photograph that I have taken at the Polo Grounds. He supplied me with most of the photos, and the drivers that I interviewed, the 19 different drivers, all had their own personal photos. I was very fortunate, and that's why we wanted to feature a whole lot of photos. And I believe there's like 160-some pictures in that book.
Ken, at your last book signing, you had 350 people show up to get a copy of this book and get it autographed. Now, that says a lot about the content of this book. Can you explain to the listeners what this book is about?
Yeah, well, it starts out with my going to the races for the very first time at the age of 10, and probably by the second being scared to death by the noise of that, until I actually got to see what was going on, and by the end of the evening, I was sold. From that point on, wanting to do nothing else but be a race driver of some sort, particularly with the stock cars, and building my own car, is the frustration of that through the high school days, finally getting it out onto the track, and realizing not long after I raced for one summer at Riverhead Raceway that I probably wasn't cut out for this, and went back to the safety of playing in a band. Then when I walked away from it, I stayed away for quite some time. I'd go occasionally to a race, but not very regularly. But I'm a songwriter, and I wrote this song about one of the drivers that I featured in, named Axel Anderson, which his real name was. And in course of finding out if he was still around, it's 40 years had passed by, got to talking with him, and hearing some of his early stories is what gave me the idea, my goodness, if he's got these stories, imagine what all these other guys I knew have. And that's what started the book. And it involved many trips back to the Long Island area to interview these guys. It took about 2 years to put it together. And it originally came out in 1997, 98, and went out of print. Used copies of it were turning up on eBay and sites for like $125. And My son, who was 10 when I started the book, became a book designer and an art director, and he has redesigned it, and which is that beautiful cover that I, with the antique flag background, and he really put his talents to. I'm so proud of the design he did, because it's an improvement. The stories didn't really need any improving. They're updated somewhat, because unfortunately, most of these guys I interviewed were 60s and 70s, and a lot of them are not around anymore. So the 90% of the book is what I call the real drivers. My preface is how I got involved and getting their stories and retelling them, and because they're fascinating. They cover a wide area because they traveled. They ran Daytona when it was the beach course, and they ran it when it first opened up. Believe it or not, they brought these coupes down there not knowing what to expect on the big oval. And there's one car, the Ace of Spades, that's on the cover there. He's doing time trials out there, and he pulls in. He says, front end feels light. That's the wind underneath the fenders was lifting the front end off the ground at 150 miles an hour. I had no idea, so what was going to happen with the banks and so forth. Another one of the drivers in there got through the biggest wreck in NASCAR history. He drove a 57 Ford Modified at Daytona in 1960, Jim Hendrickson. That video is on YouTube now, and there was like 65 cars, I believe. It was a modified race. Fireball Roberts won it. Then following year, he raced with a Grand National in 1961. He was in the 125s, qualified like 15th with a year-old car, just backyard guys down there, plateauing it down there, starting right alongside of Richard Petty and Ned Jarrett and so forth. And watched Richard Petty go out of the park that year that his father also went out, really got hurt bad. Got on his brakes, because Junior Johnson started that. He blew the engines, put oil on the track, and there's a photo in the book of a 60 Chevy coming straight down into Junior's Pontiac. Just unbelievable. I mean, it's beyond T-boning. It's like if you dropped a bomb onto Junior's car. Neither one got hurt too bad. In fact, Jimmy didn't get hurt at all. And I say they ran Langhorne, which was at the end of the year had an open championship race, and that was a wild course. Langhorne was just unbelievable. It was originally dirt. It was open to divisions from all over the country came into that thing. And those stories, there's stories of racing the cars in Cuba. They raced midgets in Cuba and had to cancel the races because of Fidel Castro's pre-revolutionary things. A bomb went off that nearly killed a bunch of them. They got back. One story just leads to another, and it's like ultimate running board racing, and I believe it may be the first book of its kind back then. Now, there's quite a few of them out there, but this one was kind of a pioneer as far as catching these stories from these guys, which, to my amazement, as I became a writer for Stock Car Racing magazine and so forth, I found out this stuff was going on all over the country. Midwest, you know, South seems to have the crown as far as the birth of stock car racing and so forth, but it all seemed to evolve around the same time, and the stories are very similar, experiences are similar, and the talent was unbelievable.
Ken, if fans want to learn about the innovators who pioneered these cars, built these cars, drove these cars, or any of the early racing, how can they get a copy of your book and find out more?
Easiest way is on the internet is my website, spoonercentral.com, is the only address you really need. When you hit that, you're going to see a big photo of the book with a link to all the information on a preview of what's inside it, and information of the many different places you can get it directly from me, directly from printer, on eBay, on Amazon, et cetera, et cetera. There's many ways to get it as there are cars in the future, so to speak.
Ken, we really appreciate your time being with us here on The Dirt Show today. We're also going to have a direct link on The Dirt Show page so people can get on, click onto your book. It'll bring them right to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And I'm looking forward to listening to some more of your programs. Thanks to Phil Van Tassel who put us together on this. And turn left. That's all I can say.
Thanks for being with us.
Okay. Thank you.
Are you ready to ride?